I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Some neighborhoods in Philadelphia look and sound like a war zone, with residents suffering from the kinds of stresses that civilians experience when living in the midst of war, and with gunshot victims showing signs of combat trauma similar to Marines and soldiers diagnosed with PTSD. We're closing out our summer series on gun violence in Philadelphia today by looking at two innovative hospital-based violence reduction programs. Lawyer Marla Davis Bellamy is director of Philadelphia Ceasefire and co-director of the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health, and Policy at Temple Medical School. She leads a program that combines analysis of public health statistics with active intervention from community members who build relationships with those most at risk for gun violence in the 22nd Police District. And Marla Davis Bellamy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Also with us is physician Ted Corbin. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine. Also the medical director of the Healing Hurt People Program, an ER-based, trauma-based intervention strategy that works with gunshot victims. It's a collaboration between the College of Medicine and the School of Public Health. And Ted Corbin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Earlier in this week, I interviewed a young woman who's part of your Healing Hurt People program, a 16-year-old, describing, frankly, the trauma that she's been living for the last year, seeing her father being murdered, being wounded herself. And to be honest with you, I've been haunted by what she had to say, which was both very disturbing, but also one sense this young girl, she writes poetry, she wants to go to college. So she's imagining some future for herself. But I was thinking about other children in this city that live with this kind of trauma and how unfair it is that their lives are as difficult as they are.
Absolutely. And we that's the core of our program, is that we recognize that many of the young people that we work with, and unfortunately we identify them at a vulnerable point in what we call a teachable moment, after they've been victims of interpersonal injury, and really work to let them know some of the symptoms that they might experience, that they're not going crazy, and just try to help them heal from that. And it really does start with building a relationship.
Well, and we're talking about victims who have been injured. I mean, and I think in many ways we think they go to the ER, they go to the hospital, they get patched up, and then they get sent home. But that's different from what you do.
Absolutely. And we feel that that's really important, because we don't want to send them right back into the environment from where they came after they've been traumatized, they've been hurt. And identifying that and recognizing that in of itself makes a world of difference when you go up to a young person and say, I understand that you've been through a lot, and so we just want to figure out how we can help you, how we can connect you to some services to help you heal.
Well, we talk about combat stress. We talk about PTSD. We worry, and we should, about soldiers, Marines, you know, coming back from war with all the stresses of war. Are there some similarities?
Absolutely. And our young people, unfortunately, Philadelphia is plagued with violence. We were having a conversation, Marla and I, just at how rampant it is, and what why it isn't such an important issue. And I know there are so many things that are happening and need to be things that need attention paid. However, when we just looked at a snapshot at some of the young people that we've identified and that we're working with, and roughly about 77% of them met full criteria for PTSD. Mm. So if that doesn't go treated, I mean, if that doesn't go identified, it's not going to be, doesn't have a chance of being treated. So really what we're looking at is identifying and try to work with them, connect them to resources that are trauma sensitive, even trauma specific, so that we can help these young people heal. Because we do know that unaddressed trauma does feed into that cycle. It does produce chronic illnesses in the long run.
And I want to pick up on that. Marla, let me get you in on the conversation. Describe for our listeners Philadelphia Ceasefire. What is the program about?
Sure, sure. Philadelphia Ceasefire is actually modeled after Chicago Ceasefire, which is a public health violence intervention program, really treating violence as a disease. I was with a number of community members last night and talked to them about the public health approach and kind of thinking about violence as a disease and those individuals who are shooters, for instance, young people are carriers of that disease. And what we're trying to do is intervene in their lives to stop the spread of the violence. So what we do here in Philadelphia, we've actually targeted our efforts to the 22nd Police District based on data, because that particular police district in North Philadelphia has, over the past few years, the highest number of homicides and shootings in particular. And so what we've done is actually targeted 14 to 25-year-olds, and we are looking for them. We are scanning the area. We are canvassing the area. This is not a program that is connected to law enforcement, so therefore we don't get a list, for instance, from the courts. So we actually ask residents, faith leaders, business leaders, about individuals in their community who are causing a problem in that community. All too often, it can be a relative, or it can just be someone who's been standing out on the corner or terrorizing the neighborhood. And what we do is we hire outreach workers from that same neighborhood because they're familiar with the territory. Oftentimes, they have street credibility, and most frequently, they are actually ex-offenders. So they've actually experienced some of the traumatic kind of situations on themselves. So what they do is begin to cultivate a relationship with those individuals who are engaged in high-risk activity and begin to kind of mentor them. It takes a little bit of time, but it's going back to the whole notion of relationship building, because all too often, many of these young men are without any kind of foundation at home. And while we often kind of look at the criminal element of things, you know, we just think that violence certainly is learned behavior. A couple of years ago, the Philadelphia Inquirer did a feature on the violence in the schools and talked about the suspension rate, for instance, for kindergartners and first graders. When you hear that, you know it's a learned behavior. These young people have seen this violence somewhere else. And so we're trying to do what we can to identify those young people, particularly in the 22nd, who are certainly engaged in high-risk activity. We bring them in. Then our outreach workers actually are mandated to make 6 home visits a month and also call these individuals 3 times a week and just stay in their ear about kind of turning their lives around and approaching life a little bit differently than what they have been.
And what is a kind of a public health, even disease model? What does that give you?
That, I mean, I think it helps people, I think, quite frankly, it helps people to better understand why, you know, these individuals are kind of engaged in this activity. If, in fact, you know, you talked about the 16-year-old, but if, in fact, these young people have been exposed to violence all their lives, this is all they know. We had an outreach worker not too long ago. He was putting up posters in a neighborhood, and someone pulled out a machine gun and shot up the area, and there must have been about 100 kids or so, he said, out playing. The kids ducked and then got up and resumed playing like nothing had happened. No one brought their child in, et cetera. Something's wrong with that.
Well, but something has happened. I mean, it seems, Ted, from the work that you've done and even looking at the kind of stresses that not just young people, but people living in violent neighborhoods are under, things do happen. And if you're young, you know, there can be brain development.
Absolutely,
impacts.
Absolutely. Marlo was speaking. That is what we've seen and what we characterize as numbing, and all too again, that's something that goes unrecognized. And what that's interpreted as is lack of remorse. And when folks see lack of remorse, then they feel like this kid can't be helped, right, or this young person cannot be helped. And we would argue that children can, in fact, be helped. And especially they're ripe for the more attention, the more of a relationship that you develop with that person, the more that person will respond.
Marla, let me go back to you. And I know you have workers that they're out on the street,
sure,
as you said, kind of scanning the area, mm-hmm, finding mm-hmm out who might be the troublemakers, mm-hmm, the kids to keep an eye on to try to create a relationship with. I mean, it's not easy to create a relationship with a teenager or a young person, even under the most normal circumstances.
Absolutely, absolutely. We kind of call it a courting period. But oftentimes, because the outreach workers are former drug dealers from the neighborhood, some of them may be familiar with these individuals because of their past records and or relationships with older siblings. And so these outreach workers of ours have actually overcome, you know, some of the same challenges that these young people have and begin to talk to them about how they did it. Mm-hmm. And all too often, I hear people say that, you know, young people, they don't care about living and that sort of thing. I mean, we have found that the young people that we work with, they don't want to die. You know, many of them are carrying weapons just to protect themselves. And we have an opportunity also to engage with these young people when they're shot and actually brought to Temple Hospital. And we talked to them about the experience. And, you know, Ted and I know others in terms of the medical community talk about this window of opportunity. Right. And I've had a chance to talk to some of these young people. And they say then, we don't want to die. We want to change our lives. This is not how we want to live. Can you help me do that? And so that's important to note.
But they don't know how to change their lives?
They don't know how, and they're not enough, I don't think, resources and enough individuals and enough programs that are working with these individuals or young people one-on-one. I've had so many people, young people, say to me, no one has ever taken an interest in me. No one has taken the time with me like you have. And I think that's a very, very sad statement. But when we think about our own upbringing, you know, and the foundation that many of us had, I don't think we can really imagine what that's like to be out there all alone and not having the support or direction from a positive adult.
I mean, it sounds like, broadly speaking, that adults have let these kids down.
In some capacity, yes. However, I do believe, Marla touched on it, that there's generations of trauma and exposure to violence, and it's not going to be a quick fix. This is something that's going to take a long time to fix, but there has to be investment. We've been fortunate. We have the Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health, I would say, has been really innovative and creative in looking at ways to spread this word of trauma and trauma-informed practice and trauma-informed care. And that is, in fact, looking at how these different stresses do, in fact, impact the body and how people move and live in society.
And what's the kind of conversation that people in this program have? What do they want to talk about? What do they need to work through if they've been a victim, let's say, of a gunshot wound?
It's the most simplest thing of identifying you or the caseworker, the outreach worker, the social worker, physicians, lawyers, whomever it might be, just identifying yourself as someone who's willing to help. We had a young man that was identified through the emergency department. He had been shot previously, but he came to the emergency department because he was in excruciating pain. And so we referred him to the program, and after working with him, establishing a rapport, developing some trust, and telling him that we're going to connect him with some services, we're going to work with him ourselves and a mixed bag of things that we do to engage the young people. And he honestly said that I didn't know that I was able or could get health care, or I didn't know how else to get attention because I didn't think anyone would give me health care. In so many words, he was saying that he wasn't deserving after he had been shot. So there's some stigma that's associated with the young people that are brought in. And truthfully, unfortunately, nothing different from national statistics. The people that are impacted most by this are African-American young men and boys. And so there's a stigma that's associated with that on the healthcare provider side or anyone. So those are some of the things that we have to deconstruct.
And I do want to deconstruct all of that after this very short break, talking with Ted Corbin, medical director of a program called Healing Hurt People. It's an emergency-based, trauma-based intervention program. It's a collaboration between Drexel University's College of Medicine and School of Public Health. Marla Davis Bellamy is the director of a program called Ceasefire. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, bigbluemarblebooks.com.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Sometimes blaxploitation movies were a little predictable, but that's what makes them so fun.
You had to have your chase scene. You had to have your dead whitey count. Yeah. At least 20 dead whiteys.
And everybody knows karate.
Right. Everybody knows kung fu.
Kung fu.
It's kung fu.
Michael Jai White and Carl Jones, who parody blaxploitation in Black Dynamite, on the next Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The city of Tampa is preparing for a potential hurricane and a crush of people for the Republican convention. But are they ready for our barbershop? The guys weigh in on the convention, questions about the Republican platform, and other news of the week. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Borgata supports WHYY and presents Cheap Trick, Friday, August 31st, and Ray Manzarek and Robbie Krieger of The Doors, Saturday, September 21st and 22nd, both shows at 9 p.m. Ticket details at theborgata.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Again, talking with Marla Davis Bellamy. She is the director of Philadelphia Ceasefire. It's a program that intervenes directly with those at risk for gun violence in a particularly violent part of Philadelphia, the 22nd Police District. Ted Corbin is medical director of the Healing Hurt Program using trauma intervention strategies for gunshot victims. The final of a four-part summer series we've been doing looking at the problems of violence and gun violence here in Philadelphia, and also talking about some solutions as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Marla, you said something earlier about learned behavior, that what you see, or perhaps the people working your program see, is a kind of learned behavior where maybe people react in a violent way if there's some kind of problem, or they're dealing with some kind of an argument or difficulty. Mm-hmm. Help us understand that learned behavior, where that came from.
Well, for instance, when I talked about the kindergarten students, for instance, the first grade students, I had an opportunity actually to survey some years ago some first grade teachers and kindergarten teachers, and they talked about many young students coming to school now very unprepared in terms of academically, but very violent, kicking teachers and kicking classmates. And they talked about years ago, you would find the same group as being very nurturing. And that's not the case anymore. And we see this throughout the city. And what we're talking about is these young people are seeing this. They're experiencing it firsthand. They're seeing it at home. They're seeing it in their community. They're seeing it on television. They're rapping about it. And so they are just overwhelmed with all of these negative messages about how to respond. And what we begin to, especially when you're talking about someone who's 5, 6 years old, we had a daycare workers, for instance, who were charged earlier this week about making these 3-year-olds fight each other. I mean, this is kind of what we've come to. And if, in fact, this is all you know, and this is what you've been exposed to all your life, your mother's been engaged, your father's been engaged, your sister's been engaged, brother's been engaged, then, you know, certainly I'm not the physician or the psychologist, but I think that you would be more apt, you know, to become engaged in an activity versus someone who didn't have that same level of exposure. And so what we're trying to do is tell these young people that there are definitely disadvantages in terms of being engaged in this kind of activity, but this is something that you don't have to do, that there are other options. All too often, we were just talking the other day about many of the young men who begin becoming fathers. And then we start talking about, you don't want to be this kind of role model for your children. And all too often, they say that, you know, this is not what I want for my child. So I need to begin to think about how I'm resolving disputes. And that's, you know, that's another component of what we do, because we're deeply engaged in conflict resolution, trying to mediate these arguments before they escalate to violence, which is so critical, because all too often you see the argument that has festered over a period of time, and then there's this gun violence eruption. So we're able to get information from our clients and neighbors about, you know, some beef that's going on between a clique on the street or a clique in the school, et cetera.
Well, and you want to weigh in on that as well, Ted. And I mean, I hear some themes here. Both of you are involved in different kinds of programs, but it sounds like maybe working with a similar kind of population, a population that has grown up amid violence.
Yes, and we see the same young people. Unfortunately, we see them at a point where they've experienced some type of traumatic injury. Mm-hmm. And we take advantage of that time really to give them an opportunity to choose change over retaliation, and that's no small feat. We have some really skilled social workers and outreach workers that are working with us at Hahnemann Hospital and also at St. Christopher's Hospital. But in many instances, we feel that we can do as much as we can with them there at the hospital. We also extend some of our services outside of the hospital, and there are different components to the program, but we do need the complement of Ceasefire that Marla is the director of in our vicinity, because you hear what happens from, you get stories from the young people, and they are in many ways afraid of certain things that take place in their neighborhoods.
But maybe don't show it, or if something happens to them, they feel a sense that they need to avenge something that might have happened to them?
Yes, they feel that they might have to avenge, and in some instances, it's to, if they don't go back, the assumption is that they had done something. So there's a whole different language and culture. I'm learning as I work with the young people as well. But these are things, mm-hmm. and when you get down to the core of it, it makes sense in terms of how they perceive safety. Carrying a gun isn't safe from our perspective.
No, but for them it is?
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the fact about young African-American men. Is that what we're talking about, even with your group, Marlon?
Absolutely. Certainly, it differs from a geographic area. But certainly in the 22nd District, that's a target. And we've just seen numerous programs, and as well as funders now, beginning to look at this particular demographic. We are having a problem, whether it's crime, whether it's education. And we need to really kind of closely examine what's happening to our young men and boys.
And are the fathers there? Are there adult men in their life? Is that part of the problem, do you think, Marlon?
I often struggle with that.
Yeah, no,
it's extremely complicated.
The reason why I struggle with that, because you have some individuals who don't have fathers. However, they're able to kind of overcome, or there's some father figure or someone in the neighborhood who's kind of taken them under their wing, or a teacher, someone who's had that kind of influence. And so, you know, that's why I struggle with that. I mean, certainly, you know, I think two-parent household family may be an ideal situation for many folks. But, you know, all too often, particularly when you're talking about the African-American community, that's not the case. And so, but we can't utilize that as a point to excuse, you know, some of the behaviors that we are seeing.
What do you think, Ted?
No,
because that is complicated.
And yeah, I think it's extremely complicated, and I think it does stem from, again, generations of trauma, of so many things that have influenced what and when I say trauma, I don't want to just it's not just the, you know, the physical aspect of it, but you have these larger oppressive things that happen to. Unfortunately, they happen to people of color, and that in of itself fuels this whole cycle. Mm-hmm. It's poverty, it's racism, it's sexism, it's so many things that fuel all of this, and kind of become encompassed into our young people's behavior.
Do you also think that it's not just poverty, but a kind of concentration of poverty, where? It's intensely poor people living in close proximity, maybe without the kind of contact outside of that community. I want to make broad generalizations here, but mm-hmm. you run across that word, you know, concentrated poverty, mm-hmm. and the kind of psychological effect that it might have.
I think that's part of it. I don't think that's all of it. I think there are people that are under-resourced but have the ability mm-hmm. to... But there is something, there is someone, something that really does help right. Change the development of young people. So I said, it's really complicated, and I don't think that it's only poverty. I think it's, and I don't think it's just close proximity. I think it's a myriad of things right. that really fuel all of this.
But you both said, you know, if you have somebody in your life, that can be a great, I mean, to use the kind of disease model, that can be a great inoculation, perhaps, against some of these problems.
Sure. I think that helps. But kind of going back to the poverty issue, many of our young men that we work with, they don't have jobs. Robbery is certainly up. You don't have to have a PhD to really understand what's happening here. And many of them don't have employable skills. So what we're talking about is a generation of many of young men who've dropped out of school and or they have a record, so therefore that works against them in terms of employment. So we've got to figure out, I believe, as a city, how to re-engage these young people into something more positive, because they need money to survive. This is a particular time, and Ted talked about learning so many things, you know, mm-hmm. from these young people that we work with. And, you know, they've told me this is back to school time. So many fathers are going to be really concerned about not having the funds necessary to buy their children new school clothing, etc. So they said, oh, yes, you're going to see a heightened number of robberies around this particular time of year because this is what this is about. And you can understand if you're trying to provide for your child, you want your child to have clothing, shoes, etc., and you don't have any means, legal means, to do this, then you're going to begin robbing or you're going to continue to sell drugs and things of that nature.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Marla Davis Bellamy. She's a lawyer, director of Philadelphia Ceasefire, co-director of the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health and Policy at Temple Medical School. Ted Corbin, an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Drexel University College of Medicine, and he's the medical director of something called Healing Hurt People Program, a ER-based, trauma-based intervention strategy. Again, a collaboration between the Medical College and the School of Public Health. And this is the final of a four-part series looking at violence, specifically gun violence in Philadelphia, and looking at these two innovative hospital-based violence reduction programs. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Marla, I know your program is based in part, as you said, on a program that began in Chicago. There was a documentary made about that called The Interrupters. Mm-hmm. And looking at places where it has been tried in other cities, it looks like it can dramatically reduce the amount of violence.
Absolutely. The program in Chicago started 15 years ago, so they certainly have a track record in terms of reductions. They started out in one police district and are probably in about 30 or so now. Initially, you know, when they started the program, there were certainly reductions. I know many people have heard about the troubled summer in Chicago now and the increase in terms of shootings. But there are probably about 12 or so cities now across the nation who are duplicating the effort. And cities like Baltimore, for instance, has some success. They've implemented the program. It's been about 5 or 6 years now. And they've seen decrease in terms of crime. And there are some other areas, even in New York, in Brooklyn, for instance, in Queens, they've seen some reductions. Even here in Philadelphia, we've actually seen a 35% decrease in terms of homicides in our particular area.
In the 22nd.
But again, we, you know, because the whole notion of evaluation also is very critical to be able to say that we certainly had an impact. And we need the funds to do that. But we have, you know, we know what the numbers are. And that's basically how we measure success in terms of outcome measures of our program, looking at just reductions in terms of homicides and shootings.
And are you talking literally about the people that work for your program stopping fights, intervening when there might have been some kind of a scuffle or even some kind of a shootout?
Absolutely. Because what we do is we actually plot on a map, you know, where the actual shootings are occurring, where our arguments are occurring. And if, in fact, there's a particular concentrated area where violence is erupting, what we begin to do is try to identify young people that we need to recruit into our program. We had that happen earlier in the summer in terms of Strawberry Mansion. And so then we began to really reach out to community organizations to kind of talk about what's happening and what resources are needed to engage our young people.
Ted, do you mostly work with gunshot victims?
We actually work with anyone that's been intentionally injured. So that's gunshot victims, it's assault victims, and also knife stab wound victims. And we take a slightly different approach in that we identify them in the emergency department, or if it's severe enough when they're hospitalized. And we establish a rapport. We give them some basic trauma, 101 trauma education about some of the things that they might experience. And then we do an assessment to see what it is that they might need. And we meet them where they are to work with them to get to those services. We all of our work is based in the work of Sandra Bloom and Dr. John Rich, the sanctuary model, and also trauma-informed practice. And Marla brought up a good point. It is important. Evaluation is a huge, huge part of making sure that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. We've been fortunate. I've been fortunate to be a Stoneleigh Foundation Fellow, which is allowing us to do an evaluation of the program. And we're not so much looking at the longer, broader piece of are we decreasing violence in Philadelphia? We're looking at it a little bit more proximal, looking at can we decrease the development of post-traumatic stress in these young people? Can we decrease depression? Can we improve sleep quality and quantity? And those are all some proxies that really do feed into the cycle of violence.
And if it's untreated, the risk for either being a victim or even perhaps even a perpetrator, is that increased?
It's higher, yes.
It's higher.
Yes.
So without the kind of interventions and treatments and education, they're at greater risk for...
They're at greater risk of injury, re-injury.
For re-injury.
Or perpetration, yes.
And Marla, what's the relationship between Philadelphia Ceasefire and the police department?
I love talking about that.
In fact, you have a big smile on your face.
I do, because we have a wonderful relationship with the Philadelphia Police Department. Commissioner Ramsey is from Chicago and therefore was familiar with the ceasefire model. And right now we're working very closely with Captain Lee. Formerly it was Captain Bard of the 22nd Police District, who was actually with us every step of the way over the past 3 years. But I was actually just with Captain Lee last night. And I think what happens here in Philadelphia, what has happened, we really kind of understand each other's role. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly there is a role for law enforcement. But what we're saying is that we're able to kind of get into neighborhoods, mediate conflicts, and do some things that we know the police can't do.
Because people might not turn to the police, see them as an
exactly,
ally?
Exactly, exactly. They may not turn to them, and oftentimes the police there are there after the fact, you know, after something has actually occurred. And so what we try to do is get there before it happens. And as we see, and I talked a little bit about robbery, and one of the things I was talking to our staff is that we need to identify measures that we can help some of these young people in terms of employment opportunities and that sort of thing in certain areas now, because we know it's going to be a problem.
Right.
So we have an excellent relationship. However, I would say that many of the sites across the country, Chicago's included, they don't necessarily have the same kind of relationship that we have. We're one of the few that has a good relationship with the police department. We want to maintain that, because we do believe that it's going to take all of us working collectively together to address this issue.
And if you learn about a crime that's been committed, are you required to tell the police? How do you deal with learning information that...
What we really focus on is the individual client itself, and really trying to help them wade through some of those issues, but really try to get them to stop actually engaging in violent activities, primarily using a gun. And so all too often, and you can imagine, I mean, people who don't have necessarily full trust in you, they're not necessarily going to tell you about a particular crime that they committed. They may kind of talk around it and that sort of thing. But we kind of really focus on trying to get those individuals who we know are actively engaged to stop engaging in that kind of activity. Really focusing, and we talked a little bit earlier about some of the young people, but if we can really contact or identify the leaders of the gang, because oftentimes these young people are not just kind of doing this by themselves. They're actually associated with a group or a particular individual who's highly engaged in that activity. And so we have found if we can identify the leaders of these groups or those who are significantly involved, then that'll have an impact on the rest of the individuals that kind of follow behind them.
We're almost up at a break here. Are we talking gangs or just kind of a loose group?
Well, here
in
Philadelphia, we kind of talk about cliques.
Cliques, which is different from...
versus gang. Gangs. We don't necessarily have organized gangs, and so we kind of talk about cliques, kind of small groups of individuals who are sometimes, you know, kind of engaged in violent activity.
Well, let's take that short break, and I do want to get some callers in, but first, a quick reintroduction. That's a lawyer, Marla Davis-Bellamy, director of Philadelphia Ceasefire and co-director of the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health, and Policy at Temple Medical School. Also with us is physician Ted Corbin, an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University's College of Medicine, also medical director of Healing Hurt People Program. And we do want to get some more callers, or get some callers in, I should say, at 1-888-477-9499. This is the final of our summer series looking at the problem and the solution to gun violence here in Philadelphia. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
If you can't keep from eating that chocolate chip cookie, don't blame your willpower, blame your brain. On the next Fresh Air, neuroscientist David Eagleman explains how competing networks in the brain
are all battling it out to control your behavior. And it's exactly like a parliament.
His book Incognito is out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The race against the machine. American workers are losing out to technology, not just machinists, but lawyers are being replaced by software. Also, Greek yogurt to the rescue, how dairy farmers in New York are benefiting from the craze. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's get some callers in on the conversation. We have Carl from West Oak Lane. Carl, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I think both of the programs they're running sound great. I'm wondering if anything is being done in coordination with any programs like what Lily Yee was doing.
Lily Yee.
Where she thought that, you know, it's not only good enough to go after the remedial, you know, going to address the problems, but also to think forward as much as, you know, instituting beauty or, you know, improving quality of life. And I was wondering if you could address that.
Sure. Carl's talking about looking at some of these communities. Lily A has been doing some art programs. There's a mural arts program. There are horticultural programs as well. Do you see, I'm looking at you, Ted, but do you see that? If we're going to talk about community and creating environments where people can grow and grow up, do you see that as a piece of the puzzle?
Definitely. We often say that we are but one small piece of a larger pie. And we need those other programs and resources and organizations so that we can connect our young people to. Because, again, employment is a big issue for many of the young people that we're working with, or any type of safe environment. Because safety is really a key piece in a lot of this. So yes.
Yes, is the answer. You know, we've done not just this summer, but numbers of programs about people in the city of Philadelphia, like the two of you, doing interesting, innovative, important work. And it does feel as if there are things that are going on. I mean, the city still has serious problems, but there are people on the street, sort of like yourself, Marla, that are doing things.
Absolutely. In fact, we're actually partnering with the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program. In fact, they're actually hosting a showing of The Interrupters in October. But we actually are working with them, help them try and identify some individuals who would help with a mural, actually, that's going to go up in North Philadelphia around this whole notion of violence. And so I think it gives many of our young people an opportunity to be exposed to something that they may or may not have been exposed to before. We actually had a poster contest this year. An essay contest around the notion of violence. And that's when I learned that many of our schools don't have art teachers. And so, you know, you kind of wonder what's happening here in terms of the school system. Mm-hmm. And certainly exposing some young people to the mural arts program certainly is very, very helpful.
Indeed. Carl, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Hassan from South Brunswick has to say. Hassan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Good morning. We're all ears, Hassan. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. My question, first of all, I want to thank the guest, and I also want to say I agree with most of the things they said, but there is one thing that is puzzling. Since I came to the United States, I've always hear people from our community, the black community, who have said all the good things, but I've never heard anybody taking responsibility to condemn some of those immorality, gang stories that is in our community, especially when you look at Chicago, where 50 people were killed. 3 days after that, John Zimmerman killed one man, but the whole America went in the street for that. So what happened to the 50 people? The 50 people are not important? So that's my question.
Okay, fair enough. And Hassan is saying he doesn't know why, and I'm just quoting from here, why can't the black community condemn black immorality, as he uses the word. I don't know if it does. Is that helpful? Does that help address the problems that we've been talking about, Marla?
I can only speak, excuse me, about Philadelphia, because this is where we are. And I'm certain there are probably some other communities that kind of address violence differently. I'm not sure, and I don't know if Ted agrees, that we have embraced the problem that we have here in Philadelphia. And if, in fact, that is the case, then there's probably not the kind of dialogue or the kind of outrage that we should hear. Mm. You know, I kind of think back to the Trayvon Martin case, where you had a number of marches and candlelight vigils. And this is something that we actually do in terms of ceasefire here in Philadelphia. Anytime there's a shooting of anyone in the 22nd, we actually host a vigil or something of that nature. And it's very difficult to get anyone to come out. But clearly, you know, that particular case struck a nerve mm-hmm. in terms of the African-American community. But by the same token, you know, we also had to acknowledge that this is something that happens each and every day in our neighborhoods. And we don't hear that kind of outrage. And so this is something that we have to work on. And I think, you know, I don't know if other cities certainly have been more successful. I know there's a lot of work to be done here in Philadelphia.
Well, and it sounds like you're talking about perhaps black-on-black crime, you know, that the victims, perpetrators tend to be the same race. Ted,
I take a few steps back when I hear the black on black crime, because I think it's there are multiple levels to it, and I also think that with what Marla said, it is absolutely becoming normal, and the city is not as outraged as we should be, and that's where we have to engage our policymakers. In making this the outrageous issue that it absolutely is.
What I hear Hassan saying is, you know, these people should be condemned. Does that help? Does this help solve the problem?
I don't believe that it helps solve the problem. I do believe that it is there is much more depth to it, in that as we talked about these, we're really talking about social determinants of health. When we talk about unemployment, when we talk of lack of access to health care, when we talk about all of these different things, that really does feed into this cycle of violence. And I think we have to keep those things in perspective. And if we improve those things, we will improve and decrease violence in our city.
I'm wondering too, Marla, and there often is, and I think for obvious reasons, when there are problems, you want more police officers. Then there's talk about changing gun laws. Does that address the problem as you see it?
It's funny. I spent 6 years in Harrisburg, and you know, while I think it's important to address the situation in terms of gun laws, I don't believe gun laws in and of themselves will change what's happening here. We know, and I know our senior city officials know, and the police know, the guns are here. They're already here. And so I'm not sure how gun laws would prevent some of the activity that we're actually witnessing. And I think law enforcement certainly plays a role. I think, you know, certainly, and neighbors will tell you, having that presence, physical presence in neighborhoods does make a difference. But I think the piece that we're missing, and it's somewhat sad because I think years ago, communities were a bit more actively engaged and involved, Sister Falak Fatah and a number of others. It's actually community engagement that we're really missing in a lot of our communities, because there are streets and neighborhoods where gun violence does not occur.
Right.
Because you've got block captains or others that are saying, you're not going to do this here. You're not going to sell drugs on my corner. And what we're missing, I think, is a lot of that kind of activity that once was present here in Philadelphia, and for whatever reason, it's lost. I don't think, and in fact, I know, that law enforcement in and of itself is not going to solve this problem.
Do policymakers know this?
I'm not sure. And I think that our particular city, unlike many other large metropolitan cities, has really struggled in terms of really kind of weighing or balancing this whole notion of law enforcement with programs like Healing Hurt People or Philadelphia Ceasefire. And I don't think it should be one or the other. I think we really should be working collectively together.
I see you nodding there, Ted.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it is. It's not just a criminal justice issue. We've heard some city officials say that we cannot arrest our way out of this situation or out of this problem. And it has to be a more collective responsibility from the various systems, from human services. Like I said, behavioral health has taken an active role, and public health. Mm-hmm. I think all of these systems need to come together and really collaboratively work together to fight and stem this tide of violence.
Let me see what Rick from Bridgeport, New Jersey has to say. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on two quick points. The first point was that in ceasefire, that they deal oftentimes with the gang leaders. They seek out the gang leaders. And the point that I would make is that for those people, when you confer status on them by dealing with them, that is what they crave. that's something that they desire, because in the community, people look at them as both a good and a bad person, and that they provide services sometimes. I don't think you should do that. And the second point, that they commit robberies, people commit robberies to provide for their children to go back to school, is almost a laughable point. I think you could give these people cash and they would not buy their kids new shoes. So those are the two points. I don't want to be too negative, but I feel strongly that you need to cut the head of the snake off and then
I think you were negative enough, Rick. Let me take the leader issue. He's saying don't go after the leader that confers status on that person.
Well, I'm just basically telling you kind of basically what we have experienced firsthand. And as I mentioned before, several of our outreach workers are ex-offenders, and therefore they're speaking from experience. And so so that's why, you know, we often utilize that approach. It's not the only approach, but we feel as though it's an effective one. And in terms of the whole notion of people stealing to provide for their family. You know, frequently I use the example of Trading Places. Was that the movie with Eddie Murphy?
Yes.
Where you had Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. And, you know, you took everything away from Dan Aykroyd in terms of, you know, his stature, his wealth, et cetera. And what did he do? You know, he began to become violent and do something that was criminal. And I think, for me personally, I really find it very difficult to judge and try not to judge. Because, quite frankly, I'm not sure, you know, what my life would have been like had I not had the same kind of foundation, upbringing, and direction. And we frequently say, in terms of, you know, the ceasefire kind of community, is that these are individuals, not necessarily that are bad people, but are making bad decisions. And I think that there are a host of reasons why they're making these bad decisions. But certainly trying to provide for a family is something that I think any man would want to do. And I think, you know, certainly the caller has his opinion, and there are certainly many of, you know, people who have that same opinion. But I'm just saying, based on what I've observed and what I've experienced firsthand, I think there's a little bit more to it than that.
Ted, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, and I think what often seems to be, we're not making excuses for the young people. We're actually looking and providing an explanation as to why these things happen. And I think it's unfortunate that people discount what it's like to live in certain situations that they haven't been exposed to and aren't exposed to and are fortunate not to be exposed to. So I think it does go back to judgment, and I touched on this whole issue of deconstructing this bias that some of us have. I mean, truthfully, in some instances, I think to myself, you know, why can't they do better? Why can't they do something different? But my normal is not their normal. And this is a quote taken from John Rich's book of a person, Roy. And it's ever so true. The more I talk to the young people, the more I realize that my normal isn't their normal. And so we have to recognize what their normal is so that we can, you know, so we can help them and figure out what's going to work.
And they're not those people, right?
Exactly.
Let me see what Aquasi from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
First of all, I want to thank your guests for the good job they are doing.
Thank you.
In America. But I'm from Africa, you know, third world country. And ever since I came to America, I keep on hearing, anytime there was like a violent, they keep on hearing, because when the child was growing up, there was no father. You know, the father wasn't there for the child. That's why, you know. But my point is, I don't think that's the problem, because back home in Africa, there are so many single mothers who raise children, and most of these children turn out to become lawyers, doctors. You know, so the notion that all the time we are saying, oh, because the father wasn't there for the child, that's why the child became, you know, a gangster or a drug dealer, I don't think we should feed too much into that.
Okay.
You know, because from the experience that I have when I was in Africa, you know, I saw, you know, a lot of, including my own mother, who was a single mother, and all of us have become, you know, my older brother is a law professor at Wayne University, you know, my other brother is a medical doctor in Cleveland, Ohio, the Cleveland Clinic. So,
well, obviously, let me take your call, only because I do want to give our guests a chance to respond to your comment. I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm actually looking at the clock, and I'm also looking at you, Ted, your thoughts.
Well, I agree that You know, I do believe that culture and tradition do play a lot in how we are, how we grow and how we develop. When there is a lack of that or a lack of the ability to express that, I think it does become challenging. And again, like I said, I'm not making excuses, but looking for, you know, explanations as to, or trying to help with explanations as to why these things happen here in Philadelphia. And I think the issue of violence is so different in different places. And I don't think it's an easy answer. There is an easy answer.
Marla?
I think parenting is very challenging for anyone. And I just think that we need to try to give our parents more handles. All too often we focus primarily on the young person and not necessarily understanding what's happening with that parent. Because I believe that if we are able to address some of the deficiencies or challenges that the parent is having, whether it's employment, housing, et cetera, that they will be a better parent. But we can't assume, because there's a mother or father present, that the child is actually receiving good parenting. Mm. But I think that we need to, as a community, do a little bit better in terms of providing resources and support for parents.
Well, we could go on. The clock tells when we have to end our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Our guests have been Marla Davis Bellamy, director of Philadelphia Ceasefire, also co-director of the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health, and Policy at Temple Medical School. Also with us, physician Ted Corbin, an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Drexel University College of Medicine, and he is the medical director of the Healing Hurt People Program, a ER-based trauma-based intervention program, a collaboration between the College of Medicine and the School of Public Health. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.